Good evening. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. There's breaking news on the James Foley murder. Later this evening, I will speak to Josh Rogan of the Daily Beast. The news is this. There are 500 to 600 British citizens with British European Union passports right now in Syria, in Iraq, most of them with ISIS. That's a report out of London. This is well known. What is also known is that the Syrian city of Raqqa, there is a kidnapping ring led by 10 to 15 British citizens. Three of those British citizens are known to the other jihadists as the Beatles. That is the ring the British authorities believe are responsible for the murder of Foley. We also have news from Washington, and I'm being very careful about this because this is mixed news. Mixed news is that there was a U.S. Special Forces operation in Syria recently to rescue Foley. It did not. That operation right now is revealed by a leak in the administration, question mark. At the same time, the NSA or the DOD or the alphabet soup are confirming the rescue took place. This is a confusion. We're dealing with fog of war. All those facts arrive within hours of the President of the United States, an impassioned statement about ISIS and its depravity. We will address that over the course of days. There's no quick way to solve this. The Beatles, however, that's new information, and I'll talk to Josh Rogan later on the show. We begin now with what I regard as a much more significant strategic threat to the security of the United States of America, which is Beijing, China, the Communist Party, and Moscow, the Russian Federation, linking for military cooperation, for economic cooperation over the course of this century. We're not talking about a band of British citizens on a jihadist adventure. We're talking about changes that will affect Eurasia for the balance of this century. I won't be here, but you will be. Gordon, a very good evening to you.
Good evening, John.
Gordon, we're going to Asia thanks to you and our first guest, Scott Harold, who's a political scientist at the RAND Corporation. Scott, a very good evening to you. What we have now are incomplete anecdotal reports across all of Asia of cooperation between Russia and China. We also have general talk of the new Cold War or a confrontation between Washington and Moscow over Ukraine crisis. Has China been empowered by this talk? Do you see a linkage between this and, Gordon, the incursion in the Indian frontier at Ladakh?
Yes.
A new incursion following last year's incursion.
And this is a serious one because it's at least 25 kilometers, and it occurs at a time when everyone was talking about Moscow, about Beijing and New Delhi getting closer together and establishing a sort of consensus of being able to work together. So this clearly cuts that narrative apart.
There it is, Scott. Two dots. Can we connect them? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John, Gordon, and to your listeners around the world, John. I think that the challenges that the United States and its allies, partners, and people around the world who hold those similar values of freedom and democracy and free markets dear, that they're confronting, John, is you're right to characterize it as being greater from a geostrategic realignment, if such occurs, between Russia and China, than a smaller scale incursion or the falling of a part of Iraq to ISIS. In terms of Moscow and Beijing, clearly these are two regimes that do not appreciate the U.S.-led or post-World War II, post-Cold War order, and that feel like they have both a threat that's posed to their interests from democracy and human rights, as well as a challenge by the power of the United States and its allies. Now, there are limitations on that. Russia is an energy exporter. It wants to get a high price, but it cannot get that from the Europeans now because of the sanctions. So they were forced to turn to the Chinese, and I think, Gordon, you've probably heard this too. The Chinese really forced Moscow to take a haircut on the price for the energy deal that went through, and essentially because the regime falls under Mr. Putin, Gazprom had to do so. And I think there's been a lot of griping that the price that Gazprom is going to have to accept is one that it will actually lose money on. There's also tension in the relationship to some extent because while they agree on opposing the United States, Moscow is the primary or one of the primary weapons suppliers to India, and China is the prime threat to India after Pakistan and global jihadis. So there are some built-in challenges, but there are a lot of areas of overlap too.
You know, many people talk about the Second Cold War. Some people think that it's occurring. Some others think that it isn't. Putin obviously thinks that there is a new ideological divide in the world because there seems to be a paradigm shift in the thinking of the Russians. You know, at the same time, you have the Chinese with a long-term challenge, not only to its neighbors, but to the United States. And we do see a knitting together of interests between Moscow and Beijing. And at the same time, while both of these countries think that they have each other's back, they're both roiling their respective regions. So I think that if you step back and look at this, you know, from the day-to-day news, it does look like there is this knitting together of a relationship that at least for the moment does look a little bit scary.
Yeah, I think the other thing to say on that, Gordon, I'd be interested in your feedback, is that I would characterize the relationship during the 1950s as being truly ideological, especially in the sense that Moscow was seen as the leader, and Beijing was willing to play the role of a follower up until Stalin died, and then the two split. But there was still a commonality of worldview. Now I think there's much less ideology and much more of a sense of opportunistic opposition and to the United States and cooperation on select areas. But I don't think that the peoples in either society regard the other. In other words, Russians don't see Chinese and Chinese don't see Russians as natural friends, partners, allies, the way that it was talked about, at least during the 1950s.
Oh, the early 1950s, I certainly agree with you. You had a dominant communist ideology, and clearly, you know, you had Mao and Stalin vying for with each other to be the leader of the communist world. Those days, of course, are over, but you do see two leaders with authoritarian tendencies, and clearly they do have a commonality of interest in the sense that they do think, as you said, that democratic nations do threaten their various societies. So I think that in a sense, yeah, maybe ideological was not the proper term, but nonetheless, we do see a common challenge. And, you know, you got to be concerned because the global narrative that we as Americans have is that we won the Cold War after we pried the Chinese away from the Russians. And now for the first time since, you know, the 1960s or so, we are facing a united China and Russia. And this has got to be a concern to the United States.
Scott, let's look at Eurasia, the vast continent stretching from Western Europe all the way to Japan, that can be dominated by Russia because it's in both camps. And with China as its very strong and aggressive ally in East Asia, there is no place for the United States. There's no lodgment for us unless, of course, we develop, as we have not these many years, a strong relationship with India. That doesn't exist right now. That's only perspective.
Well, I mean, I think on the one hand, John, that's certainly, you've put your finger on it, that is the concern. In the worst case scenario, these two countries do develop into genuine allies who coordinate their policies. But on another hand, to say that Russia can dominate the Eurasian landmass, I mean, look at what they've been able to do to Ukraine and to Georgia. I mean, these are small, weak countries, and it hasn't really been a cakewalk. You know, bear in mind how long it took them to, using exceptionally brutal force, to basically liquidate the opposition to their rule in Chechnya. They still haven't done that in Dagestan, and those are inside Russia's own borders. Remember, it was their effort to destroy their opposition to their governance in Afghanistan that essentially brought down, you know, was the proximate cause of the end of the Cold War because of the basically bankrupted the Soviet Union. So I don't know that they can do quite that much, but they can, make no mistake, they can certainly pose major, major problems. We're seeing the Russians talk about and actually exercise the launching of capabilities of missiles that are actually banned under a treaty agreement that they signed. Of course, the Chinese aren't even party to medium-range ballistic missile restraints that the U.S. and Russia have signed. So there are a lot of areas where these two powers can cause a lot of problems for U.S. interests. And it will be up to the strategists of this century to figure out ways to either convince these two parties that they don't share that much in common with us and that they need to with each other and that they need to cooperate with us, or else to balance them using a coalition of very, very powerful allies that we have already, Japan, South Korea, the Europeans, and then, as you said, build more alliances and more, or at least closer relations with countries like India.
Gordon, we just have a chance for a comment. Go ahead.
You know, I think that it's going to be important for us to try to pry one from the other, but I think it's going to be very difficult because they do have this commonality. And as Scott points out, you know, there are a lot of issues that are at stake here.
Scott Harold is a political scientist at the RAND Corporation, Gordon Chang of Forbes.com. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com is here with me, and we're going to celebrate the Pope, the very popular Pope, in Korea, in a Kia. A Kia is a little square car that made it look Italian to me. Greg Scarlatto, Executive Director of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. We're looking at the Pope in South Korea. The question is, the Pope's visit, which was a hit to read the reporting, the excitement in South Korea. Christianity is a dominant form of cultural identity in South Korea. The Presbyterian Church, the Protestant Church is very powerful, and they don't make the sectarian distinction that we made during the medieval ages during the Renaissance between the Catholic Church and the Protestant Church. They're Christians. Question is, what did the North Koreans make of the church of the Pope's visit? Greg, a very good evening to you. The Pope being very charming in a Kia in South Korea, did that in some fashion empower the possibility of Christianity again in North Korea? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Well, one would hope that that might be the case, but unfortunately, based on what we know, that is not the case yet in North Korea. North Korea is a religious oppressor. We are fully aware that what has happened in North Korea is widespread systematic extermination of those of religious beliefs, and here we're talking in particular about Christians, Protestant or Catholic, but also about Buddhists, also about believers in some of the native religions of Korea, such as Cheondogyo. The capital city of North Korea, Pyongyang used to be dubbed the Jerusalem of the East. This used to be the center of the Korean Presbyterian Church. According to North Korea's own statistical data, right after the establishment of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, North Korea, in the late 1940s, the religious population of North Korea was about 24% of the total population. Currently, the religious population of North Korea stands at 0.07%. Where did that 24% go?
Greg, you know, when you had the Pope in South Korea, the North Koreans were firing off all sorts of things into the surrounding seas. And then they said that had nothing to do with the Pope's visit. How do you see it?
It always has to do with South Korea continuing to establish itself as a fully responsible state, a fully responsible member of the international community. Of course, every time the Pope visits North Korea, this adds to South Korea's prestige as a developed and civilized country. And North Korea does its best to spoil the party. Remember that in 1987, before the 1988 Seoul Olympics, they bombed a South Korean plane, Cal Flight 858. killing a few hundred people in the process.
So if we step back, it almost doesn't matter whether it's the Pope or the Secretary General of the UN or maybe even the head of FIFA. All it is important is that South Korea is getting recognition from outside the world, and then the North Koreans will get upset. Is that the general dynamic you're talking about?
Absolutely. Recognition, legitimacy, these are huge issues to North Korea. Every time activists and scholars talk about North Korea's appalling human rights record, that directly affects North Korea's legitimacy. So that is the way to go. Every time South Korea organizes a prestigious a sports event, a G20 summit, every time South Korea hosts a prominent personality, of course the North Koreans are upset, and they do try their best in order to spoil the party in the South.
The puzzle about the North Korean church, there were 50,000 Roman Catholics recorded in North Korea before the brutality fell upon them at the end of the Second War. Those families remain Roman Catholic. I understand they must survive, and many of them didn't, but their children survive, or their grandchildren survive. Do we believe there's practicing Roman Catholicism or practicing Christianity in some fashion in North Korea?
John and Gordon, as you know, those of religious beliefs are seen by the regime as engaging in wrong associations. They're accused of wrong thinking, and up to three generations of the same family are punished based to a system of feudal extraction called Yeonjaje. So I doubt that too many members or offspring of those families still survive. Once again, Christians were exterminated with extreme prejudice. Catholics were exterminated with extreme prejudice. Now, North Korea claims to have a Catholic church, the Changchung Church. As a matter of fact, I have spoken with foreign visitors who have been to that church. There is no Holy Communion, no holy water, no kneeling, no baptism, no First Communion, no confirmation. What kind of a Catholic church is that?
A better Catholic church from some people's perspective, but we'll put that aside for the moment.
But we're talking about an underground. Now, we have an underground church in China, right?
We have an enormous underground churches in China.
That worries the communist lords a lot. Now, I understand the communist lords in North Korea are threatened as well. In the early church, I know this from seminary, they were suppressed in the early church in and around the Roman Empire. And the way Christians identified themselves for meetings tonight was they drew a fish in each other's hands as they passed. Have you heard any stories like that, Craig?
Well, we do know that there is an underground church in North Korea. From reliable sources, anywhere between 50 and 200,000 people. They're mostly Protestant, and this is due to the good and hard work of South Korean, Korean-American missionaries and other missionaries working in the border areas with China in particular.
Do you have communication with any of them?
Yes, with some of them, yes, certainly.
And the communication suggests that the church thrives?
Well, this is still a small number.
All right.
We have to remember that North Korea's population is 25 million, but the underground church of North Korea is certainly growing. And it is one of those forces that will be threatening the legitimacy.
Right. Well, a 2,000-year-old institution would threaten a bunch of bullies. I agree with you. Greg Scarlatu, Executive Director of the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea, Gordon Chang of Forbes.com. I'm John Batchelor. I'm John Batchelor, Lost in Space. This is Hotel Mars, Episode M. Mars. Is there life on Mars? We want the final answer. Fossil life will do. Real life is spectacular. I'll accept algae. However, right now, the question is unknown, unanswered. And what is to be done? Curiosity on the surface of Mars and Oppy were not built for testing for fossils, were not built for finding organics. There is another Mars rover planned for 2020, and that will have parts that speak to astrobiology. It will collect samples for a possible return, lander return mission, but still not directly answering the question. Therefore, Dr. Space, David Livingston joins me tonight. Good evening, David.
And good evening, John. How are you?
I am pleased to go to the surface of Mars, thanks to your and my guest, Chris Carberry, Executive Director of Explore Mars Incorporated, and this is the Mars Exolance Project. You can all find it by putting up Mars Exolance because they're crowdfunding right now the mission. They've just started, and you can contribute and participate. We'll let Chris explain the ambition. Chris, a very good evening to you. Congratulations. What is Exolance? What are you going to do with it?
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me on. Well, Exolance was conceived of last year when we found out that the Mars 2020 rover was not going to carry any equipment that would actually search for current life on Mars. Ourselves and some scientists at NASA and industry wanted to find a way to pressure NASA to actually look for life on Mars, current life on Mars. The problem is most experts believe that if there's life on Mars, it'd be below the surface. So through these discussions, we came up with a novel concept, bringing back a concept that was used back in the 90s, but not for this purpose, using penetrator probes to get below the surface of Mars, between 1 and 3 meters below the surface of Mars, whereas we'd have a much better chance of finding life, you know, below the surface, away from the radiation on the surface. And so we'll be utilizing these small penetrators, which are basically utilizing military technology, basically bunker-busting technology, but putting them to peaceful purposes, to search for life.
David?
Good evening. Chris, how do you do this? And is NASA going to let you take your penetrator probes on a NASA mission to Mars?
Well, that's a good question. Now, that's the big challenge, and what we're doing over the next year and what we're trying to raise money for with this crowdfunding is due to the proof of concept, show that not only can we get the depth that we need to search for life, but also that the G-loads on impact aren't going to destroy any science equipment or the communications or the power. Once we prove that concept, we want to try to start selling it to NASA or other space agencies. And we have a novel approach, whereas we wouldn't actually add any mass to the mission. And that sounds unrealistic. But with, like, for instance, MSL or the 2020 rover, they both, you know, MSL carried ballast. When it was coming in entry, descent, and landing, it actually had to shed this ballast. Same thing will happen with the 2020 rover. So we're actually proposing, and we're going to be investigating also with some of this money, whether it would be possible to replace some of that ballast with our penetrator probes. And since they already have to carry that weight, and they have to shed that weight coming in during the entry. And so that would be a perfect way, if it would work, to be able to add this science to a mission without actually adding any mass to the mission beyond what it already has to carry.
You have a tungsten bar. You release it, and it drives into the surface of Mars, is the theory. And then what? What's inside the tungsten bar that can do any testing?
Well, it basically, we have numerous options. Now, they've done a lot of advancement on basically what they'd call lab on chips. They're able to actually do the science with chips. So people always think you're going to have a science payload that are hitting the surface at that speed. Everybody's thinking of these little glass tubes, but that's not necessarily what they'd be doing. So we're actually going to spend the next year or two also investigating these payloads. Now, we have some very impressive help on this, including Gil Levin, who did experiments on the Viking lander. We have Chris McKay from NASA Ames helping us out, advising, and who also had suggestions on what might be the proper payload on this. But they all agree that we actually can do this. It shouldn't be a problem, you know, placing one of these experiments, you know, at the very tip of the penetrator.
David?
What type of life are you looking? Are you simply looking for organics? Are you looking for microbial life, fossils? What are you looking for?
Microbial life. You know, it's the big question is, if we were defined microbial life, you know, what is the origin of it? Is it the same type of life that we have here on Earth, or would it represent a second genesis? Now, that's a particularly big question for particularly the scientists we have involved, because, you know, you probably heard the theories that if there's life on Mars, it might be related to the life on Earth, with, you know, cross-pollinization between the planets, since, you know, Mars has had an extremely volcanic past with huge volcanoes that would regularly spew out rocks and boulders from the planet, which could have carried microbial life to Earth, you know, and vice versa. So the big question is, if there's life on Mars, did it have the same genesis as the life on Earth, or did it have a second genesis? And if it did have a second genesis, what would that mean for, what would that imply for life in the rest of the galaxy or the universe? Having two side-by-side planets, having separate genesis for life.
You're crowdfunding this at Indiegogo, and explain how people can participate, Chris.
Well, if they go for, you know, two options, they can go to our website, exploremars.org, and just, you know, the Indiegogo link is right there, or just go to Indiegogo and search for Exolance. And there are multiple different options. It doesn't matter how little people donate. They can donate as little as $10, even $1 if they wanted to, upwards of, you know, $20,000+. But anybody can participate in this, and they can donate, and there's also, we offer a lot of different incentives as well. For the lower levels, they can get mission patches, stickers, they can get signed books. You know, they can even come and watch the test for, you know, for a larger sum of money as well, or go out and to, you know, get a tour of a cave by Dr. Penny Boston at New Mexico Tech, who is one of the best experts on Mars cave analogs. So there are lots of cool incentives as well, but anybody can go on and donate as much or as little as they like, but they can participate in this and help us with a potentially historic mission.
David, one more question. Go ahead.
Chris, on the big picture, with all the stuff going on in the world, why are we so focused? Why do we care about finding life on Mars?
Well, I think, you know, this is a question a lot of people ask, but I think people are interested in it. I think we really would be blinding ourselves if we weren't interested in what's happening in the next planet. It really is our neighborhood. And this has been a question humanity's been asking for hundreds of years. You know, we are interested. And so it's hard to say why it's important, but we are interested. When we did a poll last year with Boeing, we commissioned a poll, you know, over 70% of the American public, you know, supported Mars exploration. The biggest reason why was the search for life. So I could go off and, you know, we don't have time for me to mention all the reasons why it's important, but I think the biggest reason is there is really strong support in the public. We just have to show the public that we're actually doing something, that we have a real plan and we plan to explore.
Chris Carberry is Executive Director of Explore Mars Incorporated. It's called the Mars Exolance Project. Indiegogo has a crowdfunding page up for everyone to participate. David Livingston, Dr. Space of The Space Show. I'm John Batchelor. Hotel Mars, episode N. I'm John Batchelor. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com is with me, and we're going to the matter of India-Pakistan. The relations between these two countries have been a flashpoint since just after the Second World War, since the creation of the Pakistan state and the riots that killed perhaps a million people or more in the breakup of the British colonial India. Now, here we are in the 21st century, and India has a new leader, Narendra Modi. Nawaz Sharif is the new leader of Pakistan. And everybody in India and everybody in Pakistan watches the gestures of these two leaders they approach. Sadanand Dume, writing for the Wall Street Journal, he's at the American Enterprise Institute. He's here to explain a surprise to me. Sadanand, a very good evening to you. Flip-flop Modi. Mr. Modi, a man who's understood as vigorous and aggressive and bullish and looking to advance India's cause in the 21st century, is a flip-flopper with Pakistan. How did he do that? Good evening to you.
Good evening. Great to be on the show. Well, I'm not sure if I would describe this as a flip-flop, but I would say that it is true that Modi started out his tenure in May with this very dramatic invitation to the leaders of India's neighboring countries, including Nawaz Sharif. And this was really seen as Modi, who was known as the quintessential Indian hawk, really displaying dovish feathers by reaching out to Nawaz Sharif. And now, just 2 days ago, he has decided to cancel senior talks between India and Pakistan because he felt that the Pakistanis were consulting publicly with people the Indian side regards as separatists. And so that's what's being called a flip-flop. I actually don't think it's a flip-flop. I think it's a case of laying very clear boundaries about when India will talk and under what circumstances.
So, Sadanand, what is Pakistan's next move? Are they going to try to put back these talks between the two foreign ministers, or are they just going to go away and sulk?
It's a tough conundrum for Pakistan. I mean, the main point is that right now Nawaz Sharif's government is under siege. He has thousands of protesters in the most secure part of his capital city. He has the army that has smelled blood. So I think the last thing that he really can be focused on in any case right now is foreign policy. In the longer term, it's a conundrum for Pakistan because what effectively Modi has said is you either talk to India or you talk to these separatists. Now, obviously, it's much more important for Pakistan to talk to India, but if they stop talking to these separatists or stop consulting with these separatists before talking to India, the Pakistani public could end up interpreting that as a climb down. So it's really a tough call for them.
Kashmir. Kashmir is the source of this conflict for decades. I come across an odd statistic the other day, Sadanand, and I say to Gordon as well, to remind us older people. Half of humanity was born after 1985. Half of humanity. Now that half, we welcome them on the planet, will live well into the 21st century. What memory can it possibly have of Kashmir? Who keeps this alive, Sadanand? Where is the Kashmir is the source of our grief society in Delhi and in Islamabad?
I think it's much more the case in Pakistan than in India, because India really in this dispute is the status quo power. Now, even though India claims all of the former princely state of Kashmir, as does Pakistan, in reality, both sides know that if you just froze the boundaries the way they are right now, India would be pretty happy and would go home with that. It's Pakistan that wants to change the boundary. So I think it's kept alive, really, in Pakistan because Pakistan sort of sees this as the missing part of its own country. In India, it's not really something that is so much on the front burner usually. It is on instances like this when these high-profile talks were canceled or when there are terrorist attacks. That's when sort of Kashmir bubbles up. But in a day-to-day sense, it's it doesn't carry that much urgency.
Well, Sadanand, I think this points out that it's not the age that is important. It's basically the institutions in society. It's the political elites. They're the people who keep these old disputes and antagonisms alive. And I'm not saying it's wrong for them to do so, but really I think this, the statistic from John really points out that this is age has nothing to do with it. You can be very young and still have a burning historical memory because it's been passed down by older generations.
Well, it's not just that, but kept alive by television, kept alive by the government, kept alive. But even in Pakistan, it seems that the salience of Kashmir has declined quite dramatically compared to the 1980s. And that's really because, quite sadly, really, Pakistan is just grappling with much larger problems internally right now. And so there just isn't that much oxygen to feed this Kashmir issue.
You write that Mr. Modi recently, en route to last week to Kargil, accused Pakistan of backing terrorism against India. That has the advantage of being a fact, and it's a useful fact to hold on to. I've puzzled these years why the Congress Party under Manmohan Singh and why the Congress Party in general was not aggressive in pressing a fact that the world knows. There are lots of venues to take your complaints. There's the United Nations Security Council. There are other counselors who you can go to and say, Pakistan is a violator of human rights. Mr. Modi has spoken the truth. Is that regarded as offensive in India that he's being candid?
It's very popular. It's very popular with most Indians. It is offensive to a very small section of the commentariat, which really is steeped in this old Nehruvian socialist way of looking at the world where India had to essentially self-flagellate all the time. And what Modi is getting is saying, well, you know, India doesn't have to self-flagellate. India is the democracy over here, and Pakistan has a pretty terrible record in terms of not only treating its own minorities, but also in terms of exporting terrorism, not just to India, but also to Afghanistan and beyond. And so what Modi is saying is, we want to talk to you, we want business, we want trade, but there are going to be new ground rules, and here's how we start enforcing those new ground rules.
Sadnan, have the Pakistanis ever gotten over the loss of Bangladesh, which used to be part of Pakistan? I mean, if they've gotten over that, can't they get over Kashmir?
You know, in a weird way, even though you would think that Bangladesh would be much more important, right, because they lost more than half their population when they lost Bangladesh. But in a weird way, Kashmir is kind of like the original bone of contention between India and Pakistan in the Pakistani imagination. The K, I mean, Pakistan is a made-up name. It's a made-up country. There was no such thing as Pakistan until 67 years ago. And the K in the word Pakistan stands for Kashmir. It's not a coincidence that there was no B in the word Pakistan. There was nothing to do with Bengal. And they lost Bengal because it was never fully part of their imagination, even though, in fact, it was more than half their population before the creation of Bangladesh.
I want to press you on that remark about a small part of the commentariat. In this country, a small part of the commentariat rules. Is that true in India as well? A handful of faces and names repeated every week drive an agenda in Delhi?
Yes, but there's one crucial difference, John, which is that they have much less political salience in India. So yes, they'll be on the airwaves, but as you can see, Mr. Modi just got an overwhelming majority. And so the voters are with him, the people are with him, and so the commentariat doesn't quite have the same degree of influence, I would argue.
And is that true for the Congress Party as well? Are they falling silent after all these years of not speaking the truth?
Congress Party is just confused because, on the one hand, their own instincts when in power were to go soft on Pakistan. On the other hand, they're really not quite sure how to handle this because they realize that popular opinion in this case is with Mr. Modi.
So, you know, when you look at the population of India then, you know, you have a lot of Muslims. How do they view this? I mean, do they just sort of side with Modi or do they look at Pakistan as being their spiritual home?
Well, it's a complicated question. Now, traditionally, most Indian Muslims have not really, taken Pakistan's side on the Kashmir issue. They've sided with the government of India. But with Modi, in Modi's case, you know, he has a tense relationship with the Muslim minority. They tend to keep out of this. But, you know, some of the larger trends that we're seeing in Kashmir are trends that we're also seeing in the rest of India. So, for example, you're seeing a greater level of radicalization than before. Not to say that this is still a small minority of people, but some of those same trends that we've seen in the Middle East, in Pakistan and Afghanistan, are becoming evident in India. For example, you had Indians from Mumbai out there in Iraq fighting with ISIS. So in that sense, the sort of Kashmir cause, to the degree that it's part of this international Islamic cause. To that degree, I think it has some resonance in the rest of the country.
Saadat Nandoume is a resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He's a columnist for WSJ.com. Gordon Chang of Forbes.com. I'm John Batchelor.